Well, thank you. It's good to be here tonight. If it's all right with you, let's start with prayer because I need it on these occasions. Lord Jesus, we thank you for your presence in this room. We thank you for your bringing us together for reasons that we don't fully comprehend, but that have to do with the wonderful things that you do in your kingdom and do among us. And so we ask that we'd hear your voice tonight and come to know and love you better as a result of time spent here, and that we would find your transforming power in our lives. And we pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen. Tonight we're going to talk about joyful transformation, and I'm actually going to talk a great deal about the part of your mind that we normally use for transformation but pay little attention to in the church, and that's the brain. So tonight we're going to look into that, and I'm going to need some volunteers before we get done. So when the time comes, I'm just warming you up for it. Now I'm going to need 8 of you to come up here and help me create a brain. So we're going to create a working brain before we get done. But we're going to start out with the sign that your brain is working right, and that is that you'll be in a state of appreciation. Now, appreciation is that wonderful sense that we have when things are going right, things are all in the right order. And in fact, if we were looking for the number one sign that a nervous system is running correctly, it's that it's in a state of appreciation. And when you're in appreciation, you can enjoy your food, you can enjoy your company, you can enjoy your surroundings, you can enjoy your day. When you're not in a sense of appreciation, everything becomes a problem. And so another way of saying good sign that your brain is working right is that you appreciate the people around you. And on a bad day, everything and everyone looks like a problem. So we're going to start out by feeling a little of that appreciation right now. It's actually one of the skills that we do in our training. It's probably the most basic skill. And so I'm going to suggest to you, those of you here for the conference, that you collect a number of appreciation memories over the next few days. Like I'll start out with the lasagna I just appreciated and the iced tea, and somebody offered to give that to me, and all those three things created appreciation, not to mention Dan picking me up on time and actually finding the church. There's all these things that could be done to appreciate, and we want to be able to make a list of those so that when we need appreciation, we can actually go back and remember what it was that made us feel appreciation. See, what ends up happening is that when we actually need appreciation, all of those memories are sort of shut off, and we can kind of remember that we did used to appreciate things, but for whatever reason, we can't think of anything we appreciate right now. So if you have a little list of three things, like if right now I just wrote down the tea and the lasagna, I could, if I lost my appreciation, go back and remember how I felt when I was doing those things, and that's what we want to be able to do here. High levels of emotional state of appreciation really will not only indicate that your brain is running right, but if you grew up with a brain that didn't run right, one of the best ways to get it going again is to practice appreciation. And so one of the things we recommend is that you try to feel appreciation for 3 minutes straight, and you'd be surprised how many people in the world cannot maintain a state of appreciation for 3 minutes. It's gone in under 30 seconds. But if you can get to the point where you can do a state of appreciation for about 3 minutes straight, and you can do that 3 times a day, your brain will do an interesting thing, and it'll say, well, you know what? I like that better than worrying, which is the normal other state that our brain is in, worried about something. And it will switch over, and it'll say, I think I'm going to live as an appreciative person instead of a worried person. So it's worth the training right there. It also is very good for relieving stress and other kinds of unpleasant states that we might be in. Its appreciation is also very similar to the letdown reflex that produces milk flow for nursing mothers. So those of you that had a chance to be a nursing mother, you know what I'm talking about. No one else does. But it's that sort of warm feeling of being life-giving. And it's actually the feeling that a baby has when the baby is being breastfed as well. So it's a mutual state, and it's a very warm and contented state. And so it's sort of the ideal place for most of us to learn that as we go along. And in many ways, we're trying to get back to that feeling. And so Tomorrow night, for those of you who will come back, we're going to be talking about food and comfort food. This is the initial comfort food experience for us. And we had a sense of appreciation. In fact, when you think about your comfort foods, they're the things that give you a sense of appreciation. The only problem is, as we will look later, they have begun to take on a life of their own that's separate from our relationships. And food is actually supposed to help us have better relationships, not substitute for them. But I'm getting ahead of myself here. So right now, I want you to remember a place, a food, or a person or event that really made you feel appreciation. And take 1 minute to notice how your body feels. So 1 minute silence here, and I'll just let you think about it. What is something you appreciate? And now pick out a word that you would use to describe how your body feels, what appreciation feels like for you. And you can write down the word or just make it a mental note of it. Okay, so what were some of the words that you came up with? One word. Calm, light, relaxed, loved, smile. I came up with cozy.
Melty.
You made that up, Dan. Yeah, well, okay. I like to see your creativity. Okay. Well, now the thing we've been trying to use to feel appreciation is our brain. And for this, I'm going to build a brain here. I'm going to need 8 people, and I will need you to come up here to the platform. We're going to arrange your chairs like you see in that diagram there. And since we don't have chairs up here, anyone who volunteers to be part of the brain also will have to pick up his or her chair and bring it along. So can I have 8 volunteers? There's nothing particularly challenging about this task, except it would help for the volunteer in purple to be someone who's naturally chatty. The purple one should be naturally chatty. So if one of you feels like that's your calling, bring a chair. Okay, here we go. We've got 2. Okay. So just bring your chair. Just set them there a minute. I'll get you arranged, and then we'll make sense of this whole thing in a minute. Let's see. I'm going to do this from the...
We need some ladies.
Need some more ladies in the brain. Okay. So let us put... We're going to put one person all the way in the back right here. So you brought this chair, and your name is?
Luke.
All right, Luke, you can have this chair. Now, we need someone else to sit right in front of Luke. And you are?
Michael.
All right, there we go. Now, right here, we have to have 2 people sit right next to each other in front. You can go ahead and have a seat, because you're going to be here a little while. Doing what brains do. All right. And now we're going to have 3 people up here. And who was it that felt like they were chatty? Anybody? Is that Michael?
Mark.
Well, Mark, we're going to then let you come over here because purple gets to sit right on this side. And then we're going to have the 3 others up here. And you got to sit so you're kind of looking at each other. So, yeah, this is a little awkward right there, but let's just go ahead like this. And right there. Okay. All right. Now we have a brain. Oh, well, let me tell you a little bit about your brain. Well, you just relax there. This is going to be so easy, but don't worry about it all. A little thing about your brain. It starts growing way before you're born, soon after you're conceived, and it zips up from your spinal cord, going up and going as high as it can till it hits the top of your skull. And when it gets there, it goes, man, I am better than this. I got to go farther. So it bends forward and goes all the way forward till it hits the front part of your skull. And goes, this is still not far enough. So it bends around and wraps around till it comes up, ending up right behind your eyes. So the top of your brain, if it was unwrapped, would stick up like this. You'd be another foot higher. But it just goes up, hits the top of your skull, goes forward, wraps around. And so what we have here on the brain is that it starts here at the back and the bottom of the brain, comes up, goes forward, wraps around, and these 3 are sitting right above your eye. So it's the frontal lobe. Yeah, it's way up at the front. It's the part that they take out if they give you a lobotomy. It's also the part that thinks of itself as me. So you take these 3 out, and me is gone. And then we've got the left side of the brain. Very conversational part of the brain. And lonely, yes, indeed, can happen to you quite a bit. So, all right, so here's what we're going to do then. What it turns out is all the information coming into your brain starts in the back on the right-hand side and goes forward, provided everything works right. And then this group in the front turns what they have figured out over to the conversational part of the brain to talk about whatever they've come up with. Now, that's when everything works right. So we're going to go ahead and work our way through this a little bit, one layer at a time, and then we're going to talk about what happens when it doesn't work right. By the end of the night, I'll have you reading brain scans. We'll be looking at brain scans of addictions and all kinds of other sorts of things, and you'll be able to figure out exactly what kind of problems those brains are going to have, because all of this will make sense to you. Now, but let's start in the back. Level one of the brain, and that's your part right there. Your name again?
Luke.
Luke, yes, Luke. Well, in this particular case, you're also called the attachment center of the brain. Now, what the attachment center at level one is interested in is what's personal to me. So there's many, many things in around us that are personal to us and they make a difference to us. So we look at the whole world looking for what we care about. So when I got off of the airplane, I was looking for some familiar face. I don't know how many other people I saw, but the one that made a difference to me was the one that was personal to me. So for our reality, as far as our brain is concerned, everything is personal. And that, you know, means my computer. There may be others in the room, but I haven't thought about them because they're not mine, right? Do we notice all of the things that are personal to me? And when there's nothing personal for you in the whole world, you feel miserable and very lonely, very alone, very abandoned, very miserable. And when you feel that way, all of the rest of the brain's going to feel it too, because everything starts with you and goes forward. If you don't bother to notice something, the rest of them aren't going to notice it either. It all starts with what he pays attention to, because that's also the center for consciousness. Well, now he passes it forward to level two of the brain. And level two is that little red spot up there called the amygdala. By the way, you're officially called the thalamus, if you want to know. The amygdala is also paying attention to everything goes on, and you actually have three opinions, only three opinions. When you look at everything, you're going to decide, is it good, is it bad, or is it scary? You got no other opinions than that. So everything that comes by you, you either ignore it, you got no opinion about it, or you're going to say, that's good, or that's bad, or that's scary, right? So do you have a food you like?
Yeah.
Lasagna, okay. When you see lasagna, you would say that is?
Good.
Yeah, yes. And when I start getting your opinions, they're going to bring this over here. So, lasagna is?
Good.
All right. Now, if you see someone pointing a gun at you, that would be?
Bad.
Yes. Uh-huh. And if it looks like they're maybe going to shoot it, it might also be?
Scary.
Scary, right. Okay, three opinions. And here's the interesting thing. Once he makes that opinion about something, he always remembers that he never changes his mind. So it's kind of tricky. Once you make up your mind, nobody can change it for you. The rest of your life, you're going to decide, either I love lasagna or I hate lasagna. It's bad and I won't. No one will get that past my lips. And the thing about these two is they're both subcortical, which means they're so deep in your brain you can't reason with them. So if something scares you, like let's say you're scared of heights, or elevators, or flying, or whatever it is, and someone tries to talk you out of it and say, no, don't be scared, it's just a snake, that kind of snake isn't going to hurt you. But if you got an opinion that is bad and scary, you are not going to change it, no matter how much I try to argue with it. Have you ever tried to argue with number two here, and somebody tried to talk them out of something that they had that feeling about, and they just wouldn't change? Yeah, some of you have. Marcus did. Okay. Well, if these two are off, you're unconscious. You're out cold. So anytime you're awake and processing, these two are involved. In fact, even if you're under anesthesia in the hospital, these two are still running. So anesthesia won't even knock them out. But anesthesia will knock everybody else out here. So what actually happens under anesthesia is these two run by themselves. The rest of these guys just don't know about it. So you don't really care. Because remember, the three up in front that are me weren't there, and we don't care, which, by the way, is going to lead us into a discussion about amnesia and stuff like that, because if these three are knocked out for whatever reason, they don't know about it, they don't care, it didn't happen to me. Now, these two know it happened to you, but the rest of these may or may not, because it's got to get passed forward. So it gets right here, and this level three is the yellow part up there. It's called the cingulate cortex, and in level three, you share two minds. This is where I can begin to think what it is that you're thinking or feeling or responding in response to whatever's going on. So when I see Marcus smile, I think, you know, he's listening. Maybe he's happy. He's trying to look like he's, participating in all of this. And so then when Barbara has her arms crossed like that, I figure, well, how am I going to interpret that? See, that depends on how well I know Barbara, right? Otherwise, I could say, well, she's defensive, or she's cold, or this is just how she likes to sit because her back doesn't hurt. See, it all depends on whether I've shared that experience with her. That's what it means to have two minds. And so as we get to know somebody, we share experiences with them. We know what an expression or a look or reaction means to them because the two of us have come to an understanding. This is actually a mutual mind state, and it's possible for us to enter into mutual mind states with other people that are very, very necessary for our being able to handle life. One of the definitions of a trauma is that it is something that we can't really share with anybody else. It always leaves us feeling alone. So a trauma will begin to divide the brain up in terms of how well it works, because at this level it says, well, I can't really share that with anybody. I can't tell anybody about that. If anybody knew that about me, they wouldn't like me or whatever the thought is, and so we become isolated. But then, should it be able to be shared? Let's see, we got a diagram here. Okay, we do. Here's a few of the things that this level three does. It's the synchronization center for the self. So in other words, this part here, level three, makes the whole brain work together. If it's not working together, it's because something has gone wrong at level three. At the backside of it, we call it the mental banana because it just ended up looking like a banana and we'd colored it yellow. So this makes it funnier. It helps us identify members of our own species. If you damage this in a monkey, they'll sit on their little monkeys as though they were rocks. They can't recognize that they're also monkeys. And so this is one of the things that we do in here. It lets us, gives us our nesting instinct. It gives us our personal space, tracks eye movement so that we know who's looking at us. Because a very important part of sharing mutual mind state is having someone pay attention to us. So as soon as someone looks our direction, we tend to think, oh, they might want a mutual mind state. And so it's very important to us. It also does dance movement or sports or things like that that coordinates how we move in space with other people. At the front end of this system, we have the part that ties together the brain functions. It does our emotions so that if I smile at you and you smile back, we both start to feel a little joy together. That's a joint emotion. It also does our energy levels. So if you walk into a room and everyone's quiet and you say, you quiet yourself down, that's because you notice that the energy is kind of low in this place. Now, some people come in and they don't notice that, right? And they go on being loud because that part of their brain isn't on and running correctly. It hasn't been properly trained. It also allows us to understand what other people are thinking. It says there's a mind behind the face I'm looking at, and that mind makes a certain amount of sense. And it lets us coordinate our actions with other people. And it's also the source of joy smiles. So there's two kinds of smiles that we can do. There's a smile for the camera, and then there's a genuine joy smile that says, I really like you. This is the part of your brain that does the genuine smile. If you knock it out, you can't do genuine smiles anymore, but you can still smile for the camera. And the same thing with you knock out the smile for the camera center, which happens to sit out here by your ear. You can still do genuine smiles, but you can't smile for the camera when you're asked to. And then finally, it's also the source of internal and external motivation of all kinds. So what you find out, if this part of the brain is having trouble, suddenly I don't have any motivation. And that's one of the things that happens when we're depressed or having a bad day. We feel alone. We're sort of miserable. We just don't feel motivated for anything. This is the part of the brain that's now having trouble. Okay. And it's copied from your mother between 2 months and 9 months of age. So basically, you're born without this part of your brain running. And it's got to learn how to act just like you have to learn how to speak. So it's called the mother core because you borrow it from your mother's brain between those ages. Now, if your mother isn't available, you'll try to borrow it from anybody that you can get it from. The reason why you'll try to borrow it from your mother, though, if you can, is that this part of the brain is larger in women than in men, and you always like to follow the big banana. So if you can, you'll learn how to basically be a human being. These are all the skills required to relate to other people like a human being. You know, at 2 months of age, babies don't do a whole lot of relating. They don't follow you. They don't understand what you're thinking. They don't know what you're trying to do. They don't smile yet in response to your smiles. But by 9 months of age, they interact a whole lot, and they've learned to do that. This is the part of the brain that's done it. All right, so what happens, though, this is a brain scan here. Can any of you pick out the yellow banana on that brain scan? It's sort of lumpy, isn't it? So the actual shape of it varies from person to person. But what ends up happening when it goes bad is that it actually gets too active. So this is a scan of the parts of the brain that are too active. The yellow part up there is so active, in fact, that if it was a muscle, we would say it's in a cramp. You ever try to move or do anything with a muscle that was in a cramp? Painful if you can move it at all, right? And so this is what we have here. This part of the brain gets into a cramp when it doesn't learn to quiet itself. And the inability to quiet yourself is the strongest predictor of developing a mental illness across your lifespan. So how well we quiet ourselves, which is very closely associated with appreciation, is the business of level 3 here of the brain. Learning how to do all of those kinds of things. All right. Well, now we'll move up to level 4. That's the blue part. And now you realize the brain is wrapped all the way around, and it's now sitting right above your eyes. And it would be the right orbital prefrontal cortex, which means it's on the right. And orbital means it's right above your eye, the orbit or socket of your eye. And prefrontal means it's not quite all the way to the front. So all of that technical stuff to say. On the right side, above your eye and not quite all the way to the front of your brain, is a spot that thinks of itself as you. And this part of your brain has 3 points of view. Here is the prefrontal area looking at the brain from below. And here is a short list of the things that it does and only it does. But let's look at them. For one thing, it's 35% of an adult brain, but it isn't there when you were born. And how much it grows is directly related to how much stimulation it gets. The stimulation that makes it grow is joy. So that if you are getting a lot of joy, it will grow large. And if you don't get much joy, it won't grow much at all. It's like a muscle. You don't use it, it doesn't grow. So we could actually scan your brains and find out how much joy you've had throughout your life. Because as you grow, you accumulate more and more brain up in this area. It thinks in images and pictures and feelings. It actually doesn't use words. It's a center for emotional regulation. So it's the one that lets you stay in your own skin. Does joint focused attention, which means if I'm directing your attention to something, you will pay attention to it. You ever tried to get an animal to look at what you were pointing at? Like you talk to your cow and you say to your cow, hey, look at that over there. And the cow just kind of looks at you because it doesn't do joint focused attention. Its prefrontal cortex is sadly lacking. There's bad news for cows, but good news for us. Also allows you to switch your focus of attention. So if I was to say to you now, are your backside starting to get tired of sitting? You see, might not have been thinking about that a minute ago, but right now I can get you to switch your attention. This is the part of your brain that does it. It does your personal preferences, creativity, satisfaction, goal-directed behavior, moral and social behavior. And by the way, it's the only part of the brain that can do that. So if that part of your brain isn't running, you are no longer doing things in a goal-directed kind of a way according to your moral standards. And you are not deciding whether what you're doing is satisfying. So you'll do the same thing over and over and over again, regardless of the consequences, because it's not on this list right here, but one of the things it does is it helps you figure out the least damaging alternative. So if I felt you weren't paying attention, Well, you are paying attention. But if I felt you weren't paying attention, I could always haul off and kick him one, right? But this part of my brain would say, you know, that is not the best, least damaging alternative. You could come up with something better than that. Like, you know, you could call him by name. There's all kinds of alternatives. And sometimes you notice when this part of your brain shuts down that you do something really stupid. And a few seconds later, you look back at it, you go, why did I do that? How did I react that way? Well, it's because the part of your brain that knows about your morals and your goals and things that are important to you and lets you choose the most helpful alternative was off at the moment, so it didn't run the math. So you just did whatever reaction came to mind. And we find those patterns happening right there. Now, the other thing that this group up here can do is it can actually quiet down the back of the brain. Remember I said you never change your opinion? All right. So let's say, in my case, I was very scared of dogs. The reason I was scared of dogs was because where I grew up in South America, dogs were not pets. They were actually brought over by the conquistadors, and they were a war animal. They used them to chase down the natives and kill them. And so they were all pretty good at chasing you down and killing you. And besides, there were no rabies shots, so there's lots of rabid dogs running around. And so the dog would chase you down, bite you, and you'd have to wait a month to see if you were going to die from rabies, which is a rather painful way to go. And I was bitten at least 3 or 4 different times by those, and I went through that. And my level 2 had an opinion about that. What was my opinion about that? Dogs are? Yeah, scary.
Scary.
Yeah, very scary. Now my wife was raised with little Dachshunds and other kinds of cozy house dogs. And so her idea was we should get a dog. What was my opinion about that?
Scary,
yeah. She wanted to reason with me. Oh, of course, but they're so cute. They're so nice and little. They are.
Scary.
Right. And so I said, it's really quite simple. You have a choice. You can have me or the dog. I don't care what you pick, but you're both will not be in the house because dogs are.
Scary.
Yeah, they're not going to be around here. Now, my more reasonable parts up here could see that they are these fuzzy little cute things that never hurt anybody. But you had an opinion, right? Mm-hmm. And it wasn't changing. And so, you know, for 15 years, no dog. But you see, that is actually a trauma intruding itself into the present. And the problem that I had, I'll go ahead and give you a hint up here, was that this part of my brain was actually trying to talk level 2 out of it. But he doesn't listen to reason. He has got an opinion, he's never going to change it. So the more I told him, what's an unreasonable thing, don't be afraid of it, the more he said, you don't get it. That's scary. Yeah, pay attention up there. Who's driving this bus? Those things will kill you. Right? And I said, no, you're making an idiot of yourself, right? Well, you like being told you're making an idiot of yourself? No, it's bad, right? It's bad. So this went on and on and on, never got out of there. But there actually is an alternative, had I known it at the time, and that is to say, oh, we know that some dogs are really scary. Let us take it over and we'll examine this dog carefully and see if it's one of the scary kinds. As soon as you knew they were paying attention to it, you go, okay, I've warned them, that's all. I don't have to worry about it anymore. He goes back to sleep. I passed on the word they're paying attention to it. You ever had a thing happen like that in your life? You're trying to get somebody's attention to wake them up, to understand there's a problem here. And the more they say there isn't a problem, like someone broke into our house, right? They broke down the front door, and the police arrived, and the front door of my house is now broken down. It's 11 o'clock at night. They're looking around going, so, wow, some really big guy to break down the door like that, you know, really smash the thing. We know what kind of a guy we're looking for. Well, go ahead and go back to sleep, you know. And I said, no, you don't get it here, see? You already told me he's a big guy, and he smashed the front door, and now I don't have a front door on my house, and I'm supposed to go back to sleep. And you know, I'm trying to get them to understand that this is not a good situation. You just don't waltz off and leave somebody with no front door, right? If they didn't, so they eventually got the point. You go, oh, all right, well, he's a big guy. Well, he should be easy to find. We're going to drive patrols around the neighborhood and keep a lookout for him, and we're 99% sure he won't come back here again tonight because, you know, he's been caught once. So he's not going to be back, and we'll be looking for him. Go, oh, now you get it. Now I can go to sleep. Well, my wife didn't have quite so easy a time going to sleep. But that was because they started to take it seriously. See, and this is what we can do here. often the things that we try to get rid of out of our lives are things that we really need to take more seriously. If we look more seriously to see why this keeps bothering me, we might actually come up with some solutions for it. But just trying to make it go away doesn't seem to work at all, the way the brain is wired. Because for one thing, the brain isn't wired to send any information back down this way except to say we're taking over and we're going to take it seriously. Otherwise, the information all comes up this way and you can pass it over to the other side. Okay, now, when all of this is working together, we call it our brain's relational circuits. And the only reason we call it that is because while this is running well, I feel like I'm in relationship with God and others in the world. I'm part of the human family. I've got connections. I've got things going for me. And when this part isn't running right, we can't pass this quiz here. Now, you just feel like you want to make a problem or person or feeling go away, your relational circuits aren't on. And you don't want to listen to what others are feeling or saying, your relational circuits are on. If your mind locks on to something upsetting, again, relational circuits, something in this part has shut down. If you just want to get away or fight or freeze, or you're starting to feel like you want to aggressively interrogate or judge or fix other people or give them a piece of your mind, that's all signs that something is broken down on this side of the brain. But when all of that is running right, so here you see something that's interesting to you. You pay attention to it. Actually, it's got pointy ears, and it's yellow, and it's got fur, and it runs around on the ground. And so you say, ooh, I think I know something about that. But you're not sure quite what it is. You pass it on to level two because you've got three opinions about this. And how do you have your three opinions? Because this man has access to your library, all of your memories. What do you know about things with pointy ears that run around on the ground? They got little teeth and they got tails that go like this back and forth and they got fur. And they say things like meow.
I think they're good.
You think they're good, and you might think of them as a cat. Yeah, sort of house pet, a good thing right there, right? Okay. So now you pass that on to you, and you think in terms of the relationships that you've had, where are all the places that cats have shown up? Has this been something that's been a part of your house or family or neighborhood or childhood or anything else? You've got all of those memories. And so you say to yourself, cats are the sort of things that you can share with other people, right? When a cat comes in, there's not a problem. We can keep talking. We can pet the cat if we want to. You might say Aunt Bertha's allergic to cats, you know, and so we might have to be careful with them, but you're adding all of that in. We handed up to level four now. Level four is where we answer a very interesting question. What is it like us to do when there's a cat around? What do me and my people do?
Show emotion.
You might show emotion, right? What else might you do when there's a cat around? You might pick it up, might pet it, you might relax, right? Okay, so at this point, they have processed this. By the way, this whole process that we're talking about here takes about 3 to 6 seconds to get all of that process through. It starts very fast. But to get all of those memories and what all we do with cats, you know, we have to gather a few things around. They will pass that over to you. Oh, I better get the microphone now. Because while they don't have any words, they just have all these feelings, you actually have all of the words in the brain and all the stories about it and everything that you can say to talk about cats. So what would you tell us about cats?
My personal opinion or what we started with back here?
Well, you're
a match, right?
Well, yeah, because they've told you how they feel about it now.
Unfortunately, they said good, right?
Right, they got good. Right?
I guess purring, here, kitty, kitty, rub it against your legs.
All that sort head, of. All
soft for
yeah.
you.
Mm-hmm, yeah. So
except
you,
for black cats. Except
black cats, yeah. Right. So you can talk about cats all you want because you've gotten all of the memories and all the feelings that come up with it, and whatever you say is going to make sense. However, what happens in the brain quite often is that something goes wrong in the processing over here. And if anything goes wrong over here, this group doesn't end up telling you what it's about. They don't pass you any information. Then all you've got to do, all you can really do for us, is describe whatever's right in front of you. Because you're always looking out of the front of the brain. You can see out through the eyes. So now, if you don't know what's going on, you're going to have to make something up, and something that sounds and looks reasonable to you, because your job is to give a reasonable explanation for everything you see.
Am I looking at the animal, or am I just looking at anything?
If you see the cat out there, you would say, okay.
I'd say look at the jaguar.
Yeah, because they look at the jaguar, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Or look at the bright light, or look at
Yeah, it could have been the bright light. You're trying to figure out what's going on. It could have been the cameraman over there. You don't know what the reaction is to, because the brain didn't bother to tell you.
Right.
So you're just going to have to look out the front of your head. Now, when I was 3 years old, I went to my grandmother's house and met the first cat. It was a yellow cat. I didn't know what it was. And I ended up chasing it out of the room, and then I came back and said, Jimmy chased lion out of room, because I thought yellow furry things were lions, and you had to get rid of those. So that was, again, a poorly informed brain at work, but it goes to show you how you can come to different conclusions. All right. Well, now there's our basic brain and the five levels that are involved in processing. And before we go on, let's settle back into a state of appreciation. Then we're going to test our brain and take a break. So, appreciation feels like a reunion with somebody that I've missed, a cuddly or warm blanket, watching a baby sleep, or a happy hug, a cozy breakfast, or a cabin in the woods, a gorgeous view, the feeling of belonging. All of those things go with appreciation. My skin feels warm. My stomach is settled. A smile is on my face. I feel cozy and welcoming, lighter, restful, sheltered. And I not only feel like I belong, but I want to create belonging for other people. Now, one of the reasons that we ask you to see how does it feel in your body is that level four up here, these three are the only part of your brain that can tell you how something feels in your body. It's actually connected in up here. So if you can say what this feeling feels like in my body, it means that all of this part of the brain is working together to create appreciation, and you're able to describe it in words over there. So it's a built-in test of when you ask you, how does it feel in your body? If you can't tell what it feels like in your body, something has gone wrong on this side of your brain. And whatever you're going to be talking about is actually going to be based on less than good data. So again, this is why we want you to pay attention to what is it like in your body. So I want you to think of a food or a person you really like, and feel the appreciation and notice how your body feels. And now I'm going to ask God to bring another memory to mind of something that you appreciate that would be one of God's special gifts to you. So, Lord, would you help us to remember something that we appreciate that's one of your special gifts to us? And you might want to give that gift a name so that you could just remember it later. So it would only mean something to you, of course. But one of the things that I want you to notice is that if you're in a state of appreciation and you ask God to bring another appreciation memory to mind, they often come in rather easily. If you're not feeling appreciation and you ask for some other memory, it's very hard to bring it in. So one of the things we want to be able to do is to find the things that can kind of get the appreciation started in our mind. Okay, so hold on to the name, and we're going to look at this diagram from Australia, because this is actually a diagram of a brain pretty much like what we have right here. And you see it, what they've done is they've decided to compare a brain that is normal with one that's had post-traumatic stress. And what we have is we'd have one wire hooked up back here, and one up here, and one over there, and one back there where it's currently blank. Well, here's what I'll tell you about. On number five side of the brain are all the same things that are in this structure, but because they almost never come apart, we're just sort of, we haven't filled in everybody back there. But on this side, you just pass things back there, and they would sort it out between them. But that's basically the brain configuration we're looking at. Okay, so now that you've seen that, let's go on to the next slide. When we look at that, we've measured the electrical activity that happens in the brain when it's given a little stimulation. Something happens that they're supposed to pay attention to. Like, it could be a flash of light, it could be a sound, it could be a picture, something you're supposed to pay attention to. And those are the signals from the different parts of the brain. Now, when a brain is, we'll go on to the next one. If a brain is acting normally, what you will see is on the left side of the screen, you'd see all the sorts parts of the brain are sort of synchronized. They're doing everything at the same time in the same place, and the same amount. But on a post-traumatic brain, which is on this side, you'll notice that the brain is running off in its own directions. It's not very synchronized. And the other thing that you'll notice is that over here, the signals are quite large. And over there, the signals are quite a bit smaller in every part of the brain. So there isn't as much activity, and it's not working together. So you see the little blue spike on this side up here on the where it says control? There's this little blue spike that goes up. The little blue spike is largely related to number one down here. And that's basically the thing that says, pay attention. Something important is going to happen. The spike that's all the way down at the bottom, where you see the green line primarily at the bottom, that is when the important thing comes through the brain. So what you do is you coordinate everybody together, say, something important's about to happen, I want everybody paying attention. And in a non-traumatized brain, everybody pays attention at the same time. They notice it, they think about it, and they get a rather big signal about it because they're doing a lot of thinking. In the post-traumatic stress, you'll notice that the signal to pay attention is practically missing. And none of the brain is paying attention. So what ends up happening is things that come in, they just run through, and the brain doesn't pay very much attention to what is actually happening, because something is broken down in the synchronization on this right side of the brain. It's not running together anymore. So the effect of trauma is that it stops your brain from running together the way it should. And after that, the things in life you're supposed to be paying attention to, you don't pay that much attention to. In fact, about the only thing you really pay much attention to is whatever he's screaming about. If he's saying, bad, scary, then you will notice something is going on. But otherwise, you tend to ignore it. So what ends up happening then is that the different parts of the brain are no longer working together the way they should. And if you want to think about what all trauma does, all of the mental disorders due to the brain, they keep it from working together quite right. And so if you've got a cramp at level 3, because you're in a cramp, the rest of the brain doesn't work together right, right? If other things happen, which we'll see in a minute, things don't work together right. So let's test our brain then. Let's give it a few experiences here. So here's a normal experience we're going to give it. Let's see. All right. I'm going to presume this is a relatively neutral thing. You recognize this? Yeah. He says it's... let's get our microphone here so we can walk around. Relatively normal experience, that is...
Drinking?
Drinking, water. You recognize it? Yeah. And you have an opinion about this?
Good.
Good. All right. Not particularly strong, good, just good, right?
Necessary.
Yeah. Good. Right, good. Okay. Is this something that you can share with other people?
Yes.
Yeah? It's part of your relationships and all that sort of thing? All right. Over here, do you know what to do, how to act like yourself when there's a bottle of water around? Yeah. Okay, what would you do? What would your people typically do with one of these?
Drink it.
You might drink it? Yeah, okay. What else might you do with it, something like this?
Store it for later.
You can store it for later, yeah. What else might your people do with it?
Think about working out.
Working, yeah, you could use it for working out. You could have it for that, yeah. Mm-hmm. Anything else that you've seen people do with one of these? Recycle it, yeah. Get someone else wet, share it, yeah, stuff like that, right? Okay, so now all of those things have come together, and you pass that information over to you, and you can now talk endlessly about water, can't you?
Sure.
Can I have a water, please?
Yeah, sure. Right there you go. It's
clear, satisfies thirst, cool, refreshing, dump it over your head, just all kinds of, you know, whatever you need. Clean.
Yeah, good. See, it's no problem. That's how a normal brain would handle something, right? Okay, so now... let us do a trauma. Now, a trauma experience, I'm going to try to pick one that's not really too common to us, right? So let's say that you were to see a ticking bomb over here. Would that seem important to you?
Yes.
Yes, okay. Now.
Scary.
That's scary, yeah. Mm-hmm. And is it a little scary, big scary?
Big scary.
Big scary. All right. Okay, so let's make it a little bit more interesting then, because we're going to make a trauma. There's no reason why we couldn't run out and tell everybody about the bomb, right? Okay? So this bomb happens to be tied to your mother, who says, if you say anything to anyone about this bomb, I'm going to blow you up. Is that important to you?
Absolutely.
Absolutely important. And you got an opinion about that?
Bad.
Bad, yeah. Bad and scary. Scary and bad, right? But now we have a problem up here in terms of, do you understand your mother doing that?
Uh-uh.
That doesn't make any sense to you at all? No. You feel like going off and telling anybody because she says she's going to blow you up if you...
Not going to tell anybody.
Not going to talk. This is not something you can share with other people? When you go to school tomorrow, you won't chat with all your friends about your mom and her bomb?
No.
No? Uh-uh? Nothing like that?
Don't want to blow up.
Don't want to blow up? No, all that sort of stuff. It has now become something that... And is it big?
It's very big.
Very big. All right. So this is very big, but I can't share it with anybody. It doesn't go into the mutual mind, which means you won't pass it on to this group. Because if I can't share this with somebody, it's the kind of thing we can't talk about. This group up here never gets a chance to decide, hey, what is it like us to do when our moms strap bombs on themselves and say they're going to blow us up if we tell anybody about it? What does your cousin like to do when that happens? And how are your friends doing? What have you seen on TV? And what have you read lately about it? And, you know, what church, they must surely have taught us something about what to do about this, right? No, nothing is happening up here. This group is dead silent, all right? Okay. But now, that means that those two know about it, and they're freaked out. And they're still freaking out. And you're at school. So what's in front of you when you're at school? What do you see out there in school?
Teacher, other students.
Yeah, teacher and students. And you're freaked out. Why are you freaked out?
Because my mind's thinking about a bomb the whole time and I can't say it.
Yeah, no, you're not thinking about a bomb because no one's told you about it.
No, well.
So you're seeing students and you're seeing teacher and you're seeing freaked out. So it's got to be something about them.
Right.
And so your job is to figure out how those students and parents are freaking you out so bad because you don't know about the bomb. No one's told you about it. You can only explain it based on what's directly in front of you. You have to make something up, aren't you? You always
sure.
This side of the brain's job is to always make up an explanation for everything you see because that's your job. And if you didn't get any information, you actually will make up an explanation faster. If you had an explanation, it'd take you about 6 to 10 seconds to come up with a reasonable sounding explanation. But when you don't have it, it takes you about 2/3 of a second to come up with an explanation. And you can say, well, it's that. Just see the way the teacher is waving her arms around? Freaky. She hadn't waved her arm like that. Well, I wouldn't have freaked out. Yeah. You see the way that girl jumped? But that's scary. I mean, kids shouldn't jump like that. Any whatever it is that you have to make up for it on the spot, you'll do it. That's how a trauma experience processes because it doesn't go through. So let's look at a trauma experience being triggered. Triggered means that it isn't actually happening right now, like the dog problem that we were having earlier, right? There were no rabid dogs chasing me down and trying to kill me at the time that my wife wants to have a little mutt in the house, right? So, but triggered is I'm having all the reactions to being chased down by a conquistador dog that's going to kill me when she's just talking about having a little mutt in the house, right? So that's a triggered experience. I'm having feelings, but it's not about the current event. Just something reminded me of it, all right? So I'm going to start with you because I know what they're freaking out about because you're going to have to explain this to us, all right? You're a woman. Yeah, I get a microphone again, yeah. Yeah, you're a woman and your husband wants to go play golf and it's on Saturday and you are super upset, and he does this every Saturday. And some days he goes ahead and plays, and then he comes back, and he's all in a good mood, and you're still upset. And other times when he stays home, he is just really grumpy, and you know it's obvious that he, you know.
Because he didn't go play.
Yeah. So what's going on here? What's wrong? Can you explain this for us?
Why are you always like this? Why do you? You know, why do you do these things? Why don't you listen to me?
Mm-hmm.
You don't care.
Yeah.
This place is falling apart. Why don't you do something? you know.
Yeah. This way every week. You know.
Exactly. Always. You're always like this. You always make me feel this way.
Yeah. What kind of person is he?
Yeah. You don't think of anybody but yourself.
Yeah.
It's coming really easy for him.
She just keeps laughing. That's
yeah,
the problem.
Yeah, that's right. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So he's got it, right? Okay. Now, so everybody wants to know in this audience, because you're very smart, what are these two thinking about, right?
The bomb.
What are they thinking about?
Are we still thinking about the bomb?
Well, you might be thinking about the bomb. Yeah. So, but we don't know, see? And that part never thinks to ask what's going on over here because it's not his business. He's used to having the information given to him. So let's start with this group. Can you explain it to him?
Explain what to him?
Oh, you know, he's
we're neglected.
You're neglected? Yeah. Do you know how to act? Yeah, you're confused. Yeah, you don't know how to act with this situation. What is it like you and your people to do under these conditions? Yeah, she's got that deer in the headlight. Look, that's exactly what this part of the brain is doing. Like, I don't know what to say here. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Now, what's going on in everybody's mind here with this? What are you sharing with others?
I'm not even sure what the issue is.
Yeah, I'm not sure what the issue is. You don't know how to explain it. All right. So let me tell you what he saw. He saw the man getting ready to leave, right? And what? Yeah, thought he was bad and scary because what he remembered was that when she was 12 years of age, her parents got into her fight. Her dad got into a car and drove away mad, and she's never seen him again since that day till now, which is more than 15 years later. So she sees man getting ready to leave, never comes back, and she had a thought about that, which is, he doesn't love me. Do you feel unloved when your dad leaves you and never comes back?
Absolutely.
And you watch him driving away, and here's this guy, he's about to leave and drive away, and how big a deal is this?
It's a really big deal.
Really big deal? Yeah, you don't get much bigger deal than that? Mm-hmm. So you're screaming and yelling, you're carrying on, really big deal, but this group doesn't know what it's about, and this group couldn't tell you what to do. Now that you know a little information, you might have some other ideas of what to do about it. Actually, it might make some sense. But no one told the mouth. Sorry if I call you that, right? Because you have to explain it based on what you know. And this is what happens inside the brain. The things that come up that don't get handled relationally, because at this level, someone has to come in and share the experience. Had mom come out and seen the girl sitting on the stoop and watching the car go away and say, wow, you really feel bad, don't you? What are you thinking? I'm thinking he doesn't love me. I would begin to get processed together, and then she might say to her, you know, how do us women handle it when men don't love us? You know, it's not an easy question to, you know, but can we still have relationships? Can a mother still love a child under those conditions? Is it something we can talk about? Is it something we can figure out together? If all of those things had happened, what would have happened is the experience would have been processed up to here, and then you could hand it over to him and go, man, this reminds me of when dad drove away, you know? So what ends up happening then is that as the brain gets shaped by these procedures and as they resolve a trauma, this is exactly what would happen. We would say, what is it that's coming to mind? And what she said was, I get the picture of my dad driving away. Then we begin to talk about it together. We invite Jesus into the situation. We ask for his healing and perspective. And it resolves the experience was previously a trauma. And it begins to help the brain again develop normal patterns. Now, if all my life has been run in an abnormal pattern where these two are freaking out and these two are asleep most of the time, which is a high trauma life and high trauma homes, that's what it's like. These two never get to get involved. It ends up being these two and you running the show because these never learned how to act like themselves in this circumstance. They didn't learn how to stay in relationship. They didn't know how to share these feelings. Without your help, he can't even put into words what's going on in his own body because you help him figure out what it's feeling and what's going on in my own body. So you might feel something is going on, but you don't even know how to put words to it and stuff like that. And what makes it even worse is that if you get very, very high levels of stress, you'll actually damage the brain parts that are supposed to make all of this work together. And then you get things like dissociation and borderline personalities. And the thing that makes it always worse is when you have attachment pain. When level one is feeling bad, hurt, abandoned, uncared for, alone, in the middle of the circumstances, it turns up the volume on all the rest of the brain because the brain is basically an amplifier. So if you're feeling joy, the rest of the brain's going to be amplifying joy for you. And then it seems like nothing seems to really bother you. Doesn't last, doesn't knock you off balance. But if you're blasting pain all the time, nobody loves me, no one cares about me, I'm alone, if anyone ever, you know, saw me, they wouldn't like me, or whatever you want to believe about it. then the rest of the brain is amplifying that pain, and it keeps the process from running smoothly so that you can't handle all of the normal things of life. So if we're going to talk about multiple personalities, as they used to be called, or dissociative identity disorder, as it's now called, here was a study of brain scan done with multiple personalities. And the part at the top is your nose. And this is looking down at your brain from the top, so that if you're looking at my brain, it would be like that. You see, I took the hair off, but I haven't been able to get it to transparent yet. But anyway, so there's the nose at the front. And you'll notice that almost all of the personalities are mapped out in the back half of the brain. The back half of the brain is the part that's devoted to these two. So they've stored all of these reaction patterns to life that you couldn't share with other people and you couldn't decide how to handle them yourself. They've stored them back there in the parts of your brain that were meant for processing sensory memory. But remember, they don't know how to do things according to your goals or wills, all those other things that only the prefrontal cortex in the front can do. So they all come out to handle problems, life as though it was a series of problems. And when you bring out the same personality, you'll always trigger the same activity in the same part of the brain. It's very locally mapped. But when you actually have the traumas resolved, what ends up happening is now that kind of pink line that you see there, all of those parts are synchronized together. You can't really tell them apart. They're all working together. And who's in charge is the person they have up there at F3, which would be you. So everything is synchronized, and now what I'm talking about and what I'm saying and what I'm experiencing is being described and talked about as though one person were experiencing it, because all the parts of me can now work together the way they were intended to. So, which is very important to know, because sometimes when people are talking about multiple personalities and resolving it, they say, well, do they go away or do they stop existing or what happens? No, what actually happens is your brain starts running together as though it were one person, and it sort of becomes like a band instead of solo instruments. They're all playing together. You just might not notice individual instruments because the band plays together so nicely, but every part is there doing its part. Okay, so what this brain needs in order to grow together properly then is joy. Joy means, as far as your brain is concerned, we're glad to be together. That relational part that comes right in here at level 3, when, as long as I know someone's going to be glad to be with me no matter what's happened to me, nothing can become a trauma. Joy is needed to activate and organize the brain's structure. And if we live out of joy, the front part of our brain will run it. And if we don't, the back part of our brain lives out of fear. And most of our decisions are made out of fear and anxiety. A joyful identity is formed when we live in a high joy environment. It becomes our natural state. It's basically a pretty high energy state. So one of the things you have to know about joy is that joy isn't just like we're here together, but joy is that sparkle in somebody else's eye. And so in order to really be transformed, we have to go someplace where people's eyes sparkle to see us. And because the brain knows whether you're smiling for the camera or it's a genuine thing, we only get transformed in the presence of people who are genuinely glad to be with us. And that becomes the search for recovery all across the world, to find somebody who's going to be glad to be with us when we're already somewhat run over by the truck and a bit messed up. And the problem is that when we were little and we got run over by the truck and messed up and we were probably in our most lovable state, someone, you know, didn't really notice or love or care or take care of us. So who's got the faith to believe that'll happen now? See, that becomes the problem for every recovery community in the world. In the absence of a high joy foundation, fear becomes the way that we relate to others. We relate to God out of fear. We look at people as more problems, relationships, and emotional interactions become difficult. And when they're difficult, we don't practice them well. And when we don't practice them, we don't do too well at them. So we actually get worse and worse. But joy is the thing that transforms us. And that's what we want to be looking at as we're going along here. Jesus himself was joy to the world. And he said to his disciples, I've told you these things so that you can have the same joy I have and so that your joy will be the fullest possible joy. Now, that is a great workout for your brain. It actually stimulates the part in front to grow. Here's the good news. You never get so old that it won't grow if it gets joy again. It's the only part of the brain we know will continue to grow throughout your lifespan. And all it requires is some genuine joy. And that's actually what Jesus came to be. And so his followers, if they're going to be like him, ought to be people of extraordinary joy who are extraordinarily good at making sure my joy is in you and that you're having the fullest possible joy. Now, I don't know about you, but the church I grew up with didn't smell like that quite. And so we've got a little catching up to do here. The right orbital prefrontal cortex is the one that grows with joy. So here's a brain that's growing a lot of joy. And there's the joy centers right there, nice plump and full. Here's a brain that is low joy. Can you see where it's missing? Yeah, right there. That's your joy center. Now, if you were to look at the physical brain, there would still be brain there. There wouldn't be a hole. But what you're looking at is a scan of brain activity. What happens is there's no activity going on, or the activity is so weak that it doesn't accomplish very much. So it isn't like if you were to look at your brain, you could physically see the holes there. What you would look at is there's no activity going on. This brain is not living in joy, it's not producing in joy, and its levels of joy are not high enough. And this person came in to have their brain scanned because they were depressed. I wonder how that happened. So what is joy? Joy means relationship. It means that somehow someone is glad to be with me. It's face-to-face in-person experience. It comes from God and from others when they're glad to be with us. And it's something we share with others when we've received it. It's something contagious about joy that we want to pass on. If you get nothing else out of this, joy is relational. It's something that a Mars bar can't do for you, and nor can your best car. It's something that happens with another person. It's for every person, every culture, everywhere. Joyful identities are what we need for all of our social institutions, families, and everything else to grow and function correctly. For healthy development, the brain needs joyful relationships, and that's why our new book coming out is Joy Starts Here. It's basically a guide for how all of us can become joy starters for where we from wherever we are with whatever we've got going to make it go on. And then the book that we started it was this book on living from the heart Jesus gave you, because, you know, the only way that people are going to be glad to be with us when we're messed up is if they see us the way that Jesus sees us. Otherwise, we just see a messed up human being. We say, who wants that? But Jesus sees something in us that's well worth seeing, and we have to have his eyes if we're ever going to become people of joy. And so that's where all it starts for us. So I would like to thank my brain. And would you all give them a round of applause?